Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production.
Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Good to hear from you today. We're getting ready to talk some texts and think about preaching for the first Sunday in Lent. These are the texts for March the 9th, 2014. So we've been looking forward to this shift, another shift in the church year, the seasons of the church year. Why don't we talk a little bit about Lent, and then let's move into the text and what we're going to do with preaching on this first Sunday in the season of Lent.
Well, as most people know, very early church did baptisms on the Saturday night before mm-hmm. Easter, and those were adult baptisms. And through tradition grew that people prepared for this baptism, of course, as a catechumenate, as classes and other types of preparation, not just, shall we say, intellectual preparation, but other forms of preparation throughout these 40 days. And it became kind of 40 years in the wilderness. Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness became kind of a pattern. So this is the pattern of preparation. And after a bit, it moved from just the catechumenate to other folks, and it shifted a bit from kind of this preparation for baptism into more of an imitation of the fasting and prayer. You know, as piety became a little bit more morose, I would call it, the imitation of Christ, the suffering, you know, the beating, it became a little bit more penitential in an extended kind of period. And this is where you get the things like giving up things for Lent and special services, et cetera. The modern Protestant Lent's a little different most of the mm-hmm. time these days. You don't hear as much about folks formally giving up things for Lent. They kind of informally do and maybe joke about it a little bit. Some people do, some people don't. And most Lutheran churches, I know, add an extra devotional service during the season of Lent, those wonderful soup, salad, and devotional service in the season of Lent, Wednesday night or Sunday night, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Other churches have other traditions around that. But the season itself on the Sundays, which is what we'll be mostly dealing with, the Gospels kind of give a progression of Jesus from baptism, if you look back from the temptations, which were the baptism right before he went to the temptation, to the cross. So it's kind of a synopsis of Jesus' life and ministry with high points of ways in which he moved toward the cross and the various stepping places along there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the thrust of Lent, and it's kind of it's helping us aim toward it. I think spiritually, and this will tie with my understanding of the temptations, for me, it's a good time for a congregation to do some who are we and what are we called to do questions.
Right.
Because the Gospels throughout Lent are Jesus continually being challenged about identity and mission. And he's mm-hmm. continually honing in. I love a line in one of the Gospels where it said it set his face like flint for Jerusalem. There comes a point in as a congregation, as an individual, you have to narrow your choices and set your face on a particular path that involves your way of following Jesus and taking the cross you are called to take up. And this is a good time to encourage and help people kind of ask those questions.
Indeed.
About identity and mission and ministry. So it's kind of synopsis Lent for me.
It is, and I think it is very much rooted in our gospel reading for today in Matthew chapter 4, the temptation of Jesus. And, you know, there are a lot of ways perhaps to read this text, and a lot of images may flash through our minds when we see temptation. And we'll jump right into the text here in just a moment. But I think it is certainly very figurative for us in the season of Lent. We have 40 days of temptation here, the 40-day period of Lent. And there are a lot of ways in which we model this season on this very formative experience for Jesus, I agree with you, especially as I've thought about this over the years. This is a time in which Jesus is facing questions about his identity, his purpose, and it's a good time for us as the church to do the same thing. So let's get to the texts, because we've got some rich work here, no matter what text you might center on today. You could preach any of these texts or all of these texts, certainly.
Right. A couple of things, of course. There's always looking for these patterns, particularly in Matthew, of tie-ins with Hebrew scriptures. A couple of things there, the 40 days and 40 nights. 40 kind of was the biblical symbol for a long time. It might not have been an exact 40 days. And we think of Elijah and his time of prayer, and Noah and the flood, and of course the Moses and the children of Israel in their 40 years in the wilderness. And so that's a tie-in that you start thinking about there, those images. In the wilderness, there's always a the Exodus is always thought of as years in the wilderness, wandering around. My mother's current favorite joke is, why did it take the children of Israel 40 years to find their way from Egypt to the promised land? And that was because Moses was a man. He wouldn't stop and ask for directions.
But, here we go.
Oh, well. Anyway, you cut that one out.
Oh, no, we'll leave that in there for Mama Chilton.
Yeah, so the other thing in there I just leaps out at me is the references, the names that are used relative to the tempter. And I'm going to start there. You know, you got the devil four times, lowercase, so that's descriptive, not a name. Tempter, descriptive, not a name. And then in 10, you've got Satan, which is a proper name. This is when Jesus yells at him. The other time he uses it is when he yells at Peter, get thee behind me, Satan, when Peter has said, oh, you don't have to die, another temptation to divert from his path. I think that's important. Devil, Diablo, is a double-tongued one, so that gives you that he's lying, you know, the great liar, and tempter is obvious, you know, one who tests or tries. And then Satan is the same figure that we find in Job. It's a Hebrew word, and it's the adversary, the one who's kind of in the God's court, whose job is to prosecute, to take the other side, to push. So it brings up issues of who actually sent Satan to tempt Jesus. I mean, the Spirit led him into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. That's an interesting piece.
I think that is a stunning line that opens this text. Jesus is led by the Spirit to be tempted by the devil, the double-tongued one. That does bear some thinking on our part.
So I'd ponder that a little bit. A couple of other things here. This is maybe an aside, but I think it's important. I think for pastors, we need to recognize this sets a pattern that Jesus continues through this gospel and all the gospels of going off alone for prayer and meditation. And most of the time it was about both regaining strength and regaining a sense of who he was and where he's going, which is kind of where my focus for these temptations are. This is tied this year in the readings. This text is tied to both the Genesis text, the issues of the tempter, the serpent who tempted, and Jesus' obedience, and Eve and Adam's, the first couple's disobedience, is a kind of a parallelism there, point counterpoint there, which comes up then in Romans. So that's part of that possibilities of using all for the text and off that whole issue of obedience and disobedience. And then, of course, we have the three temptations themselves, which makes a real nice 3-point and a poem outline, doesn't it?
Could think that way.
One could think that way. And for me, each of these has to do with an almost right way for Jesus to be the Son of God. I think for me, this text plays off of following directly on the baptism, where he's named, you are the beloved Son of God. And then he goes, the Spirit leads him for these 40 days to be tempted. And, you know, you think back to Job, and God sent Satan to tempt Job. So there's divine involvement here somehow. that Jesus had to go through this. And what he's doing is figuring out what it means to be the Son of God. Who am I and what am I called to do? And it's interesting that in many ways, Jesus did all the things he was tempted to in his own time and his own way. He fed many people.
Right.
But he didn't turn stones into loaves. He turned fish into, you know, fishes and loaves and fed to 5,000 or the 7,000, etc. He did die. But right. Unlike what Satan thought, the angels did not come. But the script, he did die, but he was resurrected. And the scriptures say, you know, unless I be lifted up as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness. So it's the same but different. And then we talk a great deal about every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. The entire New Testament is full of Jesus as the Lord of the universe, the ruler. But he comes at it in a totally different way. This is why all of these are temptations to a shortcut.
Right.
To who it was he was called to be, which is why he yells at Peter when he mentions, I've got to die. And Peter says, oh, no, not you, Lord. He said, get behind me, Satan. It's a return of the same temptation to go away from the path.
Right.
So,
reminds me of the connection to the writer of Hebrews, who later is going to say of Christ, we have a great high priest who is touched by our same temptations, was tempted in all points just like us, yet without sin. You know, shortcuts and get rich quick and lose weight fast and, you know, all kinds of shortcuts to success have always been popular. They certainly are popular these days. And I think that's an important thing that you've just said there. Jesus is tempted with a shortcut path to something that eventually God is going to allow him to accomplish. It is ultimately a part of God's will. Just like, you know, maintaining a healthy body weight is a good thing for us, but there are unhealthy ways to try to get there. So, yeah.
I will say that the two Bubbas are experts on that. me and Slim Fast have been close friends a couple of times, and I've looked good and trim, and then I quit doing Slim Fast or Jenny Craig, and whoop, there it comes again. And
whoop, so, there it is. Yeah, yeah.
So this time around, it's, you know, that more careful eating of salads and not eating bread and getting the exercise and hoping that when it goes away, it'll stay away.
Yeah,
but yeah, exactly.
Must be some kind of Freudian slip for me to have decided to use healthy body weight as an image on this show. I don't know.
Anybody that's met the two of us knows that that's more in theory than reality. Let's just put it that way.
But I do think you bring up a good point here. And to the point of the place of temptation or testing in our lives. So that's something that I want to keep in mind as we continue through these scriptures today, because temptation comes from somewhere, and it has some kind of place in our lives. I think we often view temptation as God or the devil or some outside force saying, come here, come here, I'm going to get you. And, you know, God sort of with some sort of carrot in front of us, and I knew you'd mess up. I think there's a much deeper purpose than that.
Right.
That term, the tempter, is much more about testing for strength than it is tempting to see if you're going to mess up. And may help us as we go back to the Genesis text just in a moment. Temptation does come from somewhere, but I think there's a much deeper purpose. And I believe it is, in the end, going to be connected to your idea about identity. Who are we?
Yeah.
And who are we to be? What are we to do?
And so a real homiletic piece that can set the scene for through this examination, if you're doing a sermon off this text, is to focus a bit on Jesus' identity as a baptized child of God. And we can all claim that. But the question is, what does that mean for us in this time, in this place? You know, what does it mean in 2014, wherever you are, to be a child of God, blessed and beloved? What is the mission you're called to? And that might be a theme to preach on through Lent. It's helping people discover that.
Mm-hmm. good stuff.
Based, yep.
Okay. Well, let's go back and work our way through the other texts that are related to this temptation. And we go back to the seminal temptation text in Genesis chapter 2. What do you want to say about the first man and the woman in the Garden of Eden? There's the tree, and along comes the serpent.
Well, I think it must be all these years of having to figure up themes for Lent. For Wednesday night, I keep thinking in those terms, but I noted that the five successive Sundays in Lent, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures lesson, is a brief outline of Israel's relationship with God. So you could take these lessons on Sunday morning and preach them five in a row, or you could make it your Wednesday night. You know,
there's a good idea.
Preach on that, you know, and you've got the text because it goes, today is creation and fall. The next week it's promised to Abraham. The third week it's out of Egypt and into the wilderness. On the fourth week it's the anointing of David as king. And on the fifth week it's Ezekiel's vision of the valley of dry bones after the exile. And you could walk through Israel's relationship throughout those, that, and that's a great pattern and tied in with the others. So that's my first note I want to make about this particular text. It's really about the first couple's disobedience and the result of that disobedience. So, you know, as we look at this, we realize that in creation, one of the things the Yahwist writer is trying to communicate to us is that God gave human beings both freedom and limits. Eat anything you want except that. Anything but that you want except that. And this story is about the human propensity to violate limits. Notice the devil does not show up here unless you just want to sort of shove him in. I mean, we've got this John Milton Paradise Lost kind of thing, the image that is there, and you see pictures of Eve by herself. Read the story carefully. There's a serpent. There is no devil. And Adam is there. It says he was with her.
Right.
And, you know, and it's a crafty creature, but still a creature. And he, what he does is he presents the woman with tempting alternative questions. And all of us are experienced with that. Temptation is subtle. It is always subtle. It presents another good alternative. You won't die. You'll be like God. Hey, what could be wrong with knowing the difference between good and evil? That would be a good thing, wouldn't it? And we in our lives, we never say, you know, I think I'm just going to go do something really mean and evil.
Yeah.
At this point. Most of us aren't that way. You know, there's a few psychopaths and those kind of folks. But most of us, even those people, think what they're doing is some kind of ultimate good under some worldview that they carry. Most people do not consciously just decide to go be bad. What we do is we think through and try to reason a way in which this is ultimately a good thing. One of the things I've noticed watching recent television, you know, HBO in particular, a lot of these shows, the ultimate value is family. We used to have ultimate values of God or country or honor. Now it's, you see people excusing all kinds of things. Well, I had to take care of my family. It's about my family. Over and over. Breaking Bad is a great example. Walt over and over did all these heinous things. And he continually excused it as, I have to take care of my family.
Right.
Makes it sound like he thought he was doing bad things for a good reason. This is what the tempter does. I think this is kind of powerful. And the result of which is when you come to an awareness of how you have deceived yourself, you have that moment of shame. That's what the nakedness is. And we have done a vast disservice to women by claiming either that Eve was the tempter and the temptation was somehow sexual. They didn't know they were naked, which is a euphemism for, you know, some form of sexuality, until after. She couldn't have tempted him in that way. They were not aware of that kind of thing at that juncture. And it's a product of monastic you know, fear of women. You know, it's a great disservice. The real issue here has to do with coming to awareness of how we have allowed our freedom to go in a kind of a very selfish direction, and then we wake up and realize what a mess we've made. That's what this nakedness and shame and covering themselves.
Yeah.
There's no shame about more intense than waking up and realizing
right
what a fool you made of yourself. I love the line in The Prodigal Son. He came to himself.
Yeah.
That's what that moment's about, coming to yourself and realizing what you've done.
Yeah. I love the line just a little bit later in this story. We'll not be reading it, but as they're trying to explain to God what's happened, well, we were naked and we hid ourselves. And God says, who told you were naked? And what's wrong with that? You know, and so we do. We sort of begin to impose all of these issues of shame, et cetera. It's not really the point today, but
yeah,
what's the purpose of temptation here? We've read this story, obviously, many, many times. There's been a lot of discussion on what goes here. And as I'm trying to think through this deeper purpose of testing of temptation, and this surrounds the deep themes of free will and free choice as the gift of God. Certainly, you don't really have free will and free choice until you know that you have a choice, until you know there's another option that exists.
Right.
And so as the serpent slithers on the scene today, if nothing else, the serpent is there to let these folks know there's another choice. Oh, did God really say that? You think you really will die? You think all this stuff, well, what if it were to work out like this? And, you know, all of a sudden they're having to weigh these variables and make a choice. They're not automatons. They're not robots. They're not people without the ability to make a choice. And again, connecting back to the story of Jesus, I'm not saying that Jesus was an automaton or a robot until the devil showed up, but that's when it gets real, those temptations to the shortcut. Well, you know, Jesus,
right,
you could just turn these stones into bread and get over this hunger thing. No, I don't think I'll do that. I think I'll stay on the path. You can jump down off the temple. You won't get hurt. No, I don't think I'll do that. So it is a nice point, counterpoint, obedience, disobedience. It certainly takes us to the crux of we all have decisions to make. There are always consequences for our decisions. Some of those are good consequences. Some of those are bad consequences. But we are going to bear the weight.
Well, and if we can just kind of leap over the Psalm for a moment, to Paul, you know, that's as you know, in Romans, you can spend a lot of time on any line. I'd like to jump down to 5:18-19, which is kind of like Hebrew poetry of parallelism, which makes his basic point. This is where Paul comes to his point. Therefore, just as one man's trespass, notice he leaves Eve out of it, led to condemnation for all.
So this one time.
This time. One man's act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all. And just as one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners, so by one man's obedience, the many will be made righteous. So he says the same thing twice in two different ways. And the issue comes down to, as you just said, disobedience and obedience. Now, the questions that we have to struggle with, and I don't think we can give answers because this is where every pastoral person and preacher has to delve into their own theological understanding of these things. How can one person's sin condemn us? And how can one person's obedience or death redeem us? This really hits hard right in this area. Now, I don't think that Paul here is coming forth with a full-blown theology of the atonement. He's not got a real theory there, but he has an awareness that what happened in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus changed eternity for all of us. Mm-hmm. Neither do I think that Paul does not imply original sin in the way in which it's come to us kind of inherited through genetics. I think we can probably blame St. Augustine for that.
You said it, not me, but that's okay.
That's okay. I think you can blame him for that, and we can work through that. But I think that Paul is looking at both of these people as representatives of humanity in this text.
Yeah.
He's saying Paul, Adam and Eve are representative of the basic human condition of sinfulness. And he's playing with that kind of image all the way through here and trying to work it out in that kind of Hebrew, Jewish, whatever Pauline theologic that he uses that sometimes leaves us all going, huh? But it makes sense for him. And then, but he comes to this conclusion of those two types. And it's almost like we look at this and say, we are both these people. We are called, you know, and I had, you know, the good old Lutheran line, we're saint and sinner at the same time. So that's, I think everybody can kind of embrace that we both struggle all the time with obedience and we're called in these directions. And Paul is saying, you know, the possibility is there.
That's it.
The possibility is there.
You just nailed it from my perspective. Verse 18 is a possibility that Paul is identifying here. Therefore, just as one man's trespass led to condemnation for all, it opened a doorway. Now we have the possibility that we are all going to stray. We're all going to make the poor choice.
Right.
So one man's act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all. And we're running out of time here. And so I don't want to get into Arminian, Calvinist kind of debate here, original sin, all justified, you know, about making a choice. But it is about this incredible creative possibility that is there because of the life of Jesus Christ.
Right.
Just as there has become this devastating possibility because of the choice of humanity down through time,
right,
there is now this incredible creative, restorative, recreative, if you will, possibility,
right,
because of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's the core of the gospel that we're
right.
seeking to understand and proclaim.
And as I said, each tradition listening to this has their own theory of the atonement and how broad and all that, but none of that is implied in this text.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginning of it, and you can work that out, but it plays that image off of one another in such a beautiful way. And you go back to end with 32,
mm-hmm.
Psalm 32. It's one of the Bible's seven penitential psalms, and I think verse 1 and 2 hits it for today in such a wonderful way, in which it says, happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Happy are those to whom the Lord imputes no iniquity, in whose spirit there is no deceit. That coming of what do we do when we come to that moment of sin, and that when we've acknowledged the sin, etc., the hiding place. And it's just my old hobby horse of grace, mercy, forgiveness in the Hebrew scriptures. It's not exclusively a New Testament image. It's lives throughout the Old Testament scriptures.
And I can say amen to that, Brother Bubba. We're out of time. This is good stuff, and I think this is just pointing towards some of the great scriptures and discussions we've got ahead of us in these next several weeks in Lent. They really are good stuff. Not much left for us to do today, Bubba, but to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with I Will Arise and Go to Jesus, a Celtic setting by Michael Card.
Jesus ready stands to save you, full of pity, love, and power. God's free bounty glorify, true belief and true repentance, every grace that brings you nigh. Come ye weary, heavy laden, lost and ruined by the fall, if you tarry till you're better, you will never come at all. Embrace me in his arms, in the arms of my dear Savior. Oh, there are 10,000 charms.